Shadow Talk.
In this week's episode, we'll look at the Cambridge Analytica expose and what that means for organizations. We'll look at updates to three main banking Trojans. We'll visit RAF's ransomware corner and the Crouch and Getty attacks on critical infrastructure have been attributed. Hello and welcome to the pod. Greetings to Rafa. Hello, Raf.
Happy Friday, Mike.
Happy Friday. And Harrison Van Riper, again, 2 weeks on a trot.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Very well. Very well. Okay, let's start with the biggest story of the week. It's been everywhere. The expose of Cambridge Analytica and the alleged use of some rather underhand disinformation techniques and the access they had to Facebook data that perhaps they shouldn't really have had. Raf, let's try and navigate this minefield with making it as relevant as possible. First things first, there's been a lot of talk about it being a breach. Is it or isn't it a breach? Let's get that sorted.
So this issue of whether it's a breach or not a breach, I think this is one of the main elements of Facebook's PR response to this at the minute. You can call it a semantic issue. You can call it a distraction exercise. Essentially, we don't know that no one hacked into Facebook servers exploiting a bug. That doesn't seem to have happened. No one socially engineered or phished users for credentials. So yeah, it's not a breach. But what we do know, at least from my understanding, is that an academic researcher basically constructed a personality test app and collected data on about 270,000 people. But the app was also able to collect data of each of those individuals' friends. And it was able to do that because of Facebook's API at the time. Now, Cambridge Analytica apparently then bought this data, which managed to reach around 50 million people and then used it to perform psychological influencing operations, as you said. So specifically here, I'm talking about the Facebook API. That's what's really important to this breach or no breach issue. So that API access was provided by Facebook. It was part of their service. It had terms and conditions attached. It was actually part of their business operations. So at the time, Facebook allowed third-party apps to collect not only the data of the people who consented to giving it up, but also their friends' data. Now, this whistleblower who was interviewed by The Guardian in the UK said that the API provided access to private messages as well. We can't confirm that yet. It's still what the whistleblower had said. We're going to see later on whether that's true or not. As I said, though, the API's terms of service allowed the data to be collected and passed on. You could argue that this wasn't a breach because it's specifically designed in this way. It's doing this by design. The API was shut down in 2015. It was a legitimate service. Facebook's now claiming that I had asked Cambridge Analytica to delete that information and that the data had been misused because the academic researcher had told them that he would only use it for academic research rather than selling it on. So I think that's really the crux of this issue in terms of whether it's a breach or not. And I think because it's by design that the API is providing this sort of information, then technically Facebook is actually right by saying it's not a breach.
I think Mark Zuckerberg came out and called it a breach of trust, which is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, I think that might be part of the PR response as well, trying to move the blame away from Facebook itself, trying to distance themselves, buy themselves some time. What I would say is I'd be extremely surprised if there aren't a lot of other companies having similar types of data sets out there, given that this API was open to everyone to buy and use. And there's plenty of data sheets out there. You could see how the API was structured, all the user guides on it. It stopped operating in 2015, but there's probably going to be a lot of companies and developers who got their hands on it before that point.
Yeah, we'll see how that pans out and what data the developers of Facebook apps will get in the future. But let's move on for now, because there is some more interesting stuff that I think is more relevant to organizations that came out of this expose. And that was in the undercover videos that filmed some of the meetings with Cambridge Analytica. What I thought was interesting was the techniques that they were talking about using in terms of like seeding certain news stories into what they call the internet bloodstream. And that's something that we've seen quite a bit of in the past few months and few years.
Yeah, we've talked about it previously when we talked about disinformation campaigns. We did it on a couple of weeks ago on the pod as well. So this whole injecting false news stories into the internet bloodstream, to use Cambridge Analytica's words, and then watching it disperse. This is obviously aided by social media now. You can basically put a story out there and within seconds, it's halfway across the world and people are retweeting it or posting it again on Facebook. Now, in the research that we did last year in terms of this information, we talked a lot about some of the tools that you can use to perform this type of activity. So you've got spoofing tools. So you can use sites like CloneZone to impersonate sites. You can modify documents. as well, and then send them out and try and tweet them or use whatever channel you want to try and disseminate them online. Then one thing we talk about a lot is typo and domain squatting. It's a simple, but it's a powerful technique. You register a domain to look like a legitimate one, you change a letter here or there, and you can fool a lot of people. And we saw this fairly successfully during the French elections, where a Belgian news outlet called Le Soir was spoofed using a domain squat that then published a fake article about Emmanuel Macron being financed by Saudi Arabia. So at first glance, a lot of people started retweeting this, and it even managed to get into the hands of politicians across France. So you had members of the Le Pen family and the National Front retweeting it, thinking that it was a legitimate news story.
Yeah, what I also found really interesting about kind of the techniques they were talking about was their reference to the use of proxies to disseminate this information, as well as all the social media stuff as well. And in this instance, they appear to be referring to influencing real NGOs and charities that would then share their stories and get the message out. But it reminded me of all the disinformation campaigns that we've also seen. There's loads of different kind of levels of proxies that can be really, really effective for this sort of thing. At one level, you've got the bots that will just tweet stories to real NGOs and kind of hope it just gets picked up within the Twitter sphere. You've then got the accounts which pose as NGOs or charities and think tanks themselves to add an air of credibility and maybe somebody would be duped into that. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the full-blown cutout. And the Anonymous Poland example is a really, really good example of this. At the time of the elections, they were tweeting out the... the Bradley Foundation?
Yeah, as a charity in the United States.
Yeah, and kind of that was a cutout used by a Russian state-affiliated group. And the way in which they did that with a huge amount of bots over a very, very short period to really get that up and trending was a quite sophisticated use of a cutout and using kind of social media bots alongside that as well. And we do know that Twitter bots are pretty easy to orchestrate and buy as a service online as well. There's quite a few sites that offer those services.
Yeah, I think that's really important to highlight. You mentioned the Anonymous Poland example, which we think was done by a nation state or someone affiliated to a nation state, at least with that type of capability. But bots can be bought online really easily. So we highlighted one service called Tweet Attacks Pro. Users can download a piece of software that controls social media bots. Now that costs as little as $7. And you have more managed services where you can buy between 10 and 100,000 bots for a few dollars per like or per 1,000 likes, for example. You simply input the links or the post that you want to disseminate and these bots do all the work for you. So like the barriers to entry to this type of activity is really, really low, which is why this information campaign isn't just nation states or big, rich commercial companies around the world and capital cities doing it. There's many different actors who have access to these type of tools. What's also interesting about bots actually is we've done some previous research here and some of our analysts have seen a shift towards more opportunistic and short-term targeting. So when we talk about bots for this information, we usually associate it with what happened in the US elections and what we keep seeing about Russian bots. And these tend to be quite long-term campaigns that are planned over quite a long period of time. What our researchers have started seeing recently is shorter campaigns. So I'm talking about a few hours or even a day with bots set up, immediately start doing loads of activity and then they disappear. They're like disposable bots. And we've actually just published a blog on that, which our listeners can look at. It's called Pop-Up Twitter Bots and that's available on the Digital Shadows website. Some really interesting research there.
Okay. In terms of things that organizations can do, because with that blog that you referenced, that's just as much about the targeting of organizations and people within the organizations themselves. And disinformation can really, really have an impact on businesses as well. What can businesses learn about this? We do cover this in the paper, but let's give our listeners a little teaser of what they can do.
So yeah, there's some initial things you can do, some sort of free off-the-shelf things. So there's tools online like DNS Twist. You can use that to see when domain squats are being registered. You can use Google Alerts to see mentions of your brand on forums. But then there's an educational aspect to it as well. In terms of identifying Twitter bots, there's certain clues to finding them. You can look at the age of the account, the number of followers, the activity of the post, how quickly they're posting, the type of activity they're associating themselves with as well. So there's certain things you can do to spot them, but as we're seeing, these bots are becoming more and more sophisticated. So very soon it's going to be very difficult to tell these things apart. Going back to the issue of Facebook, though, I think what's interesting here as well, at least from my perspective, is what this will do to Facebook's reputation, to their business model. Maybe it's not surprising to many in the security community, but this brings home a lot of what privacy advocates have been mentioning for a few years regarding mass collection of data by tech companies, how this can be used. So I think this is a debate that we're going to be having for quite a while now, and this has shone a light on a lot of that.
On to the second story of the week, and that's some updates to three banking Trojans. There's been TrickBot, ZeusPanda, and Ramnet as well. With on the last two, ZeusPanda and Ramnet, they've had added functionality that targets cryptocurrency holders. Specifically, they've got man-in-the-middle web injects, which when a user visits their blockchain or Coinbase account, then it makes it so that when you hit enter, it doesn't actually enter your credentials. And then they've got an overlay on the login button as well that captures that information. And this is just one example of banking Trojans that have adopted more and more functionality that hope to gain as much money as they can. And significantly, we've also got TrickBot as well. And there's been a significant update to TrickBot. This time, it's added a screen locker functionality. Let's hold off speculating on that just for a moment, because TrickBot's a really, really nice banking Trojan, and it's pretty significant. So maybe want to explain what TrickBot is, Harrison.
TrickBot started as kind of a basic banking Trojan when it came onto the scene, and has sort of evolved into a malware dropper with kind of a lot of different functionality. Last year, it was observed leveraging the Eternal Blue exploit to make lateral movements within a network, in addition to using a credential harvester to do the same thing. Back in November, functionality was added which would allow fraud operators of TrickBot to actually check the banking accounts on infected machines by using those machines to actually log in, so that from the bank's perspective, it would be a normal login with a recognized IP address. In February of this year, a module was added which would allow TrickBot to mine cryptocurrency. And this was, you know, kind of likely to try and capitalize off of the current hype surrounding cryptocurrencies. And then now we have this new screen locking module that's been added. So as it kind of started off as a pretty basic banking Trojan, because its authors have been so involved in keeping it updated, with this new functionality, it's got quite a few different tactics, and it can be employed and used by a lot of different threat actors with a lot of different motivations.
Yeah, it really shows you all of those updates, how staggering it is, the development that goes into these kind of things. Focusing on the screen locker functionality itself, what's that all about, do we think?
Yeah, so, I mean, the screen locker functionality does just that. It will lock an infected system's screen, which is really commonly seen in ransomwares. So, you know, the screen will lock and then present the user with the ransom note. And so now this specific action of actually locking the screen and presenting a ransom note hasn't been observed, but it appears to be under development. Just in general, this is kind of an interesting update to this banking Trojan, because as I mentioned before, there's already a worming capability incorporated with TrickBot through Eternal Blue. So it was possible that, you know, ransomware could be added to TrickBot's functionality in the near future.
Yeah, speaking of ransomware, we've seen quite a lot of reporting on it this week with a few updates and a few different attacks and even a new variant. So the first thing this week is a new one, and it's called the Zenis ransomware variant. So it's quite typical in some ways, encrypts victim files, but it also overwrites and deletes associated backups, which we've seen with other variants as well. The distribution method is not definitively known at the minute, but it seems to be compromised remote desktop protocol services. Therefore, organizations should really ensure that RDP services are properly secured and they're using VPNs from trusted sources to minimize this risk. The other big ransomware story is an attack on the City of Atlanta government in the States. So an employee sent screenshots of the ransom screen, and it's interesting there because you can see the demand is sort of split up. It's like a tiered demand structure. So you've got $6,000 for one machine, $51,000 for all of the machines on the affected network. Now, that's significant because we've seen this type of structure before with the Samsung ransomware. Now, Samsung is one of the most developed series of ransomware families. It's generally gone for high-profile targets like transit authorities, schools, government targets, like what's happened now in the city of Atlanta. It's a bit different from other variants as it exploits vulnerabilities in internet-facing servers running JBoss software to gain a foothold. What it also does is it usually harvests domain admin credentials and then self-propagates through networks. So you can see it's a lot more sophisticated than your everyday ransomware variant. So a takeaway from this one would be if you have a JBoss server, check that you've installed the right patch for it. The vulnerability that SamSam goes for is CVE-2010-0738. And the final ransomware update is for Gangcrab. So recently a decryptor was released for it, but now the operators have made updates the same way we were talking about with TrickBot. The latest version is still very much active and potent because of these updates. So the decryptor from before will only work on the past versions. And this is a pattern we see commonly with ransomware. It's a game of cat and mouse. The decryptors are released and then operators update the variant and keep going.
Right. Remind us of that CVE once again, Raf, for the SamSam.
It's CVE-2010-0738. So 2010, it's been going around for a while, but it still seems to be very, very effective.
2010, still being exploited.
2010, a good year for CVEs.
Okay, on to the final story of the week, and that comes from a US CERT alert on a cyber espionage campaign against US government entities and organizations across the energy, nuclear, and other sectors. Harrison, what's been going on here?
Yeah, so this alert kind of builds off of a previous alert that was published by US CERT in October of last year, which describes kind of a lot of the same tactics and techniques that's observed in this newest report. One of the things that stands out in this report specifically is that it directly attributes the campaign to the Russian government acting through this threat group called Dragonfly, who's also called Crouching Yeti or Electronic Bear. Although the kind of the ultimate objective of the campaign was critical national infrastructure, it first targeted what US CERT is calling staging targets, or you know, kind of described as peripheral organizations, including trusted third-party suppliers. So essentially what they're describing is a supply chain attack. So these networks were used as pivot points to conduct attacks against the quote-unquote intended targets. So again, essentially what US CERT is describing is what, you know, kind of people in the InfoSec community and what we here at Digital Shadows kind of describe as a traditional supply chain attack. The update also contained a lot of additional information on the specific tactics and techniques that have been observed in the campaign. So these included a lot of different social engineering techniques that were used in the spear phishing emails. They were observed compromising certain websites known to be visited by the target. So these would be known as watering hole attacks, and also using free credential harvesting tools to grab user credentials to, again, kind of navigate through this this attack.
So I think the timing of this story needs to be called out as well. So this is one of a series of recent stories where US authorities have called out Russian cyber activity. Now, some of the commentary on this since has been quite exaggerated about this attribution, claiming that it's, I don't know, somewhat novel or out of the ordinary that the US is doing this, which just simply isn't the case. Like even in the Obama administration, you had US attribution for Russian cyber attacks. This is just a continuation of that. We should remember that. One thing that's interesting for me is that some of the indicators provided in this report were overly broad, to say the least. So they'd kick up a lot of false positives and noise if you ran them through your security system. So this is just a word of caution for anyone using that report for their own defenses. Check through them, as inputting some of these indicators into your production in bulk will probably backfire somewhat. And that's not uncommon. I mean, I remember when we did the Grizzly Step report, when we looked into that last year, that also was littered with indicators from popular services like Google or from Tor exit nodes, so IPs from Tor exit nodes as well. And that just wasn't really that useful for a lot of people, and people were inputting them and just getting a lot of noise from it. So just a word of warning, when you get reports with indicators, don't just put them in without looking at them.
Okay, top tip. That's all we have time for this week. Let's have a little roundup of what we each think is the key takeaway here. I'll volunteer to go first this week. And I think we should focus on, when we're looking at the Cambridge Analytica, the API access and the changes to that and what's going to happen is interesting. But what's really interesting is the disinformation campaigns and all the different techniques that we've seen are being used there. Significantly, it's not just kind of the populations during election times that are being targeted, it's businesses as well. But if we can gain a better understanding of these techniques, then we know how to protect them as well. And Raf outlined some really, really good ways to identify campaigns such as these, kind of looking at type of squatted pages and things like that. So check out that advice and check out the blog that we've just written on that very topic. Harrison, key takeaway from you.
Yeah, so I think my takeaway this week will be kind of centered around TrickBot. TrickBot has definitely become one of the more prominent and advanced banking trojans, in my opinion, kind of on the level of Drydex, which has been kind of a mainstay in this space for a number of years now. So if you're an enterprise network defender, then TrickBot, which already has been observed incorporating SMB propagation techniques, then the notion that ransomware may be added in the future should really be something on your radar.
Yeah, and we've previously called TrickBot a banking trojan, and that's probably a bit too much of a niche term for it now. Raf, what's the key takeaway for yourself?
Mike, I'm going to piggyback on what you said, but I'm going to take it up a notch. Are you ready?
Yeah.
So like I said, the Facebook story is part of a wider debate about how much of ourselves we want to share online and of how we need to be cognizant of the scale on which personal data is being collected, of how it's being used, how it's sold, and how it's misused. So if technology companies were, and to a large extent still are, selling these big data sets, then there are going to be cases where these data sets are obtained by cyber criminals as well, or nation states. They might have similar capabilities of doing that, whether it's through breaches or other means, such as them building it themselves. So or in Europe, we've got GDPR coming in. That's just one measure that, in a very small part, aims to correct some of this. The Facebook story might precipitate similar stuff in the US and in other areas of the world. But to cut things short, my takeaway for all of this really is that we need to start thinking more seriously about this wider issue. How are you limiting your online exposure? How do you minimize the amount of information being collected on you and your organization? How will that data then be used against you to target you through this information for extortion purposes, just for profiling? And where do you stand on this wider debate relating to data collection and privacy? So a lot of things to think about this weekend.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, it's time for us to step down from our soapboxes and draw this pod to a close. Have a great week to all of our listeners and speak to you next time. Thanks for listening. For more research and analysis from the Digital Shadows team, check out resources.digitalshadows.com.